I forgot the spoiler. All right, everyone wants to know. No, the answer is very simple, that the self-force is you take the bare self-force you construct out of those metric perturbations, and you angle average it. And that's all there is to it. Okay. Now, some advantages, advertising. The derivation, advantages of that, well, it's actually really simple. Embarrassingly simple for someone who spent months doing really, really long calculations for our 2008 paper. It really involves no computation. It's kind of nice that it never loses sight of the gauge-dependent nature of the force. That's just a sort of aesthetic bonus. And the really important part is because it's so simple computationally, it really has a shot of applying at the next order, whereas at least my approach to, or Bob and my approach to harmonic gauge calculations would be a big mess. It'd be very hard to accomplish anything. Now, the result is nice because it doesn't prefer a particular gauge. It doesn't give you a tail integral. It gives you some kind of regularization thing. You give me the metric perturbations, I'll give you the self-force. So that's more useful numerically, although lots of people these days are using singular field approaches. And finally, it tells you how to compute the self-force in a wider class of gauges than just those that are smoothly related to harmonic gauge, which is sort of the previous state of the art. And it looks like John Friedman might be using such a gauge in his group. So it could actually have a big practical use. All right, so what are the ingredients for a self-force derivation? The way I view it is very simplistic. There's three steps. You assume something, you define something, and you compute what you defined. So the assumptions I'm going to make are identical to those I made with Bob Wald in the 2008 paper. I will go over those. The definition of what I mean by the position of the body is going to be very similar in spirit, but I'm going to use a slightly different definition, which allows me to consider a more general class of gauges. And then finally, the computational approach is the main difference. It's going to be this gauge-independent, much simpler approach. And I have to mention that, unfortunately, there are errors in the appendix of our paper. I really should have gotten this paper out correcting them by now, but other stuff came up. But anyway, don't use the formulas in our appendix. Wait, use this if it comes up in your research or something. All right, so the steps 1, 2, and 3. Step 1, assumptions. This is just a review of what we did. Basic idea is you're trying to do a small body approximation. So what you need is a one-parameter family of space-times containing a body that shrinks to zero size. So why do you say you absolutely need this? Well, it's a pretty simple statement. I mean, if you're doing perturbation theory, you're doing some Taylor series in the size of the body. So, you know, the terms in the Taylor series are, you know, derivatives evaluated at zero of the parameter you're expanding in. So technically what you're doing when you're doing this kind of perturbation theory is taking the body to zero size. But we can't just take the body to zero size at fixed mass in general relativity because point particles aren't allowed. You'll get collapsed to a black hole, which is really an extended object. And you just won't find one-parameter families that approach a point particle limit. So the solution is to shrink the mass of the particle down to zero in this one-parameter family as well. And the idea for accomplishing this is to demand the existence of a second limit, a scaled limit, a near zone limit we call, acknowledging the matched asymptotic expansions ideas, which were important in formulating this. And it's very simple. You just rescale the coordinates so that if you're sitting at fixed rescaled coordinates, you're sort of following the body in as it shrinks down to zero size. And then you also rescale the metric down here, a factor of lambda to the minus 2. You blow it up so that sizes stay finite, so that you're effectively zooming in on the particle in this scaled limit. And it's very simple to show that this actually always gives a stationary asymptotically flat space-time. So you pick some time t-naught along the particle's motion, you do this zooming in on it, you get a body metric, a metric characterizing the body at that time, which is stationary and asymptotically flat. So it's easier to absorb this if you keep a simple example in mind, the Schwarzschild-de-Sitter metric family. So I'm going to take the mass, I'm going to scale it by lambda, I want the mass and the size to go to zero. Of course, this is a black hole, so the size is proportional to the mass. And you can see that, you know, as soon as I let lambda go to zero, the Schwarzschild part goes away, and we're left with just a sitter in these coordinates. So the ordinary limit is the body has shrunk down, and it has disappeared. Okay, but now the scaled limit, we rescale the metric in coordinates, and the effect that has is it sort of moves the lambda over from here on the Schwarzschild term over to here on the de Sitter term, so that when you let lambda go to zero in the scaled limit, you just get Schwarzschild back. That's this zooming in on the body. So that's an example to keep in mind to understand sort of how this is working. Okay, step 2, definition. So here I have a slight modification of what we did in our 2008 paper. This is the same. The lowest order motion, we just say, is given by the world line that's sort of left behind as this body shrinks down and disappears. And we showed that that has to be geodesic. So there's no mass left behind when it shrinks down and loses its mass, but you can see where it came from, and we proved that was a geodesic. But the thing we're really interested in are, of course, self-force corrections to geodesic motion. And so we're going to use this body metric, the scaled limit that gives you the stationary asymptotically flat metric, to define those. We're going to say that when you pick some coordinates and zoom in on the body in those coordinates and get out your stationary asymptotically flat metric, compute the center of mass of that metric. See how far off you were when you zoomed in. And that is the deviation from geodesic motion. That's sort of how the body is drifting away from its geodesic. So if you go in Reggie and Teitelbaum, they derive this expression. It's the conserved quantity associated with the boost killing field at time t equals 0. And it is the center of mass quantity. So some properties. Well, first of all, I heard John Friedman mention this yesterday. This expression only, this integral only exists when the metric is even parity at order 1 over r. This condition was posed by Reggie and Teitelbaum, and people have continued it since, so I consider it reliable. People understand it, they like it. So anyway, that is going to restrict the class of gauges in which the self-force is defined, because it has to satisfy the existence of this integral. Secondly, the center mass depends on just the 1 over r squared part of the metric and just the l equals 1 part. That makes sense. It's supposed to be a center of mass. And finally, this is the most important one and the one that's taken me the longest time to establish, even though the ingredients are basically all there in the literature as far as I can tell. If there are any experts on super translations here, please come talk to me. But basically, so if you translate the coordinates, of course, this thing better change by the generator. You know, that's the center of mass. If you move the coordinates, the center of mass must move appropriately. But we want to do the most general class of gauges for which this is defined, and that would include super translations, angle-dependent translations. And it turns out that the way this changes is just the angle average of the generator. So there's really no super translation ambiguity at spatial infinity. Okay. So that was my definition. Now we just have to compute. And this is my favorite part of the talk. I'm going to fit this all on one slide. Well, two really, but this is it for the computation. So the idea is the first thing you do is ask, how does this change under a change of gauge? So you just look at, you know, what changes of coordinates are going to be such that this center of mass integral still exists. It's easy to see that your gauge vector has to be bounded, but it can be direction dependent, and it has to be even parity. That's going to induce some change of gauge in your scaled limit and your body metric. And then you can use that, you know, look at the properties of this formula, and it's straightforward to see that the change under any allowed change of gauge is just the angle average of the vector field generating that gauge. So this is what starts it all. And now the idea is to just do some very simple manipulations on this term. So first of all, let's look for acceleration. That's what we're interested in, self-force. Not the position. So that's now I'm working in Fermi coordinates. So in Fermi coordinates, that's just two time derivatives of the gauge vector, rather. Okay, but now I'm just going to do some stuff. So the first thing is I'm going to convert this to covariant derivative. That gives me some Christoffel term, but this is something like Riemann times x. And this is just the change in the metric perturbations at order 1 over r. So that's even parity, that's odd parity. It's going to average out. So that actually goes away. And here I'm just adding the, I think people call this the Ricci identity, just the Riemann tensor in terms of the commuting of the covariant derivative. Okay, so that's adding zero. But now, look, we can collect terms. This term and this term, the first and the third terms, are just the time derivative of the symmetrized derivative of the vector field, I0 symmetrized derivative. So that's just the time derivative of the change in G0i, of the metric perturbation G0i. And then this term here is just the space derivative of the change in G00, because that's just how G00 changes. So this term went away, and the other three here became this, which you may recognize as the change in the bare self-force. This is exactly the sort of perturbed geodesic equation combination of indices. These zeros are like dotting into the four velocity of the world line, and these i's are on the hyperplane orthogonal to it. Hypersurface, I suppose. And then this last bit is the geodesic deviation equation. The Riemann tensor is just of the background. It'll pop out of the angle average. And you just have the Riemann tensor dotted into the generator. OK, so now the point is we can just basically pull out the delta. Oh, I've done one more line. I've noted that this angle average of the generator is, of course, exactly how the deviation vector changes. So I have here that the change in the acceleration is given by the change in the angle average of the bare force minus Riemann tensor dot into change in deviation. But of course, now I can just basically drop the deltas. And there's some term I don't know, like the constant of integration that has to be gauge invariant, but I know all the other terms. So I know that the acceleration is given by the angle average of the self-force plus the geodesic deviation type term plus some gauge invariant correction term. So this calculation is the crux. And now we just want to figure out what this gauge invariant correction term is. So basically, since it's gauge invariant, the best way to compute it is to pick a very convenient gauge. Harmonic gauge is sort of my first, impulse, because I've done so much in it, relying on other people's hard work and a fair amount of hard work of my own. But actually, there's a really convenient gauge to put to use here, which is just the gauge in which there's no deviation from geodesic motion. So you can obviously choose this gauge. Most people in the room know that. But you've got one vector's worth of gauge freedom, and the deviation vector is your description here. So you can certainly always zero that. And that sets this term to zero, and this term to zero. So all we're left with is, in this gauge, we can compute F by taking the angle average of the bare force. OK, but the gauging isn't done. Those of you who are at all familiar with matched asymptotic expansions know that the perturbations, the part of the perturbations required to construct this bare force, actually satisfy the linearized Einstein equation about the Schwarzschild background, as long as I'm doing a spinless body. And there, the L equals 1 modes our pure gauge. And remember that, well, it doesn't matter. I mean, the angle average of a three vector here will pick out only L equals 1 modes. So in fact, those are gauge 2. And this term is 0. So we've chosen a gauge with, we've set L equals 1 modes to 0 all over the place. I haven't described it precisely, because it'd be too complicated to introduce just where this shows up in the near zone and all that. But trust me, you choose enough L equals 1, 0 gauges, and you find that, in fact, this gauge invariant piece vanishes. So the final answer is, as promised, that the acceleration is given by the angle average of the bare self-force. Geodesic deviation term we can talk about, but that has to be there in a formalism like ours. I like it there. Other people don't like it there, and do other formalisms. But the basic answer is what we call the self-force. The piece dependent on the metric perturbations is given by the angle average. OK, so I've been very polite until now. Now I'm going to go into some ideology. Things that I like about this expression. So first of all, I would say this should be viewed as a more fundamental expression than some tail integral. So the tail integral would only hold in harmonic gauge, whereas this doesn't prefer a gauge. But I would actually make the same comments about the singular field subtraction form of the force, which is sort of the most popular. If you look at how many papers write out gravitational self-force, most will write out geodesic equation for some regularized metric. With singular field subtracting off. But that's also a gauge-dependent thing. It's only been formulated in harmonic gauge. Well, it will be, it'll be true for gauges smoothly related to harmonic gauge. But if you go into a larger class, you'll have to actually get a new singular field to get the right answer. So I would say that for the same reason, this is a more fundamental form of the self-force than something involving a singular field. And I'll emphasize that I never needed a singular field. It just never arose. I never had to think about it or use it to compute anything. And then finally, the most ideological is, I just don't know what's so great about a singular field. I mean, to me, the basic physics is in angle averaging. I mean, it's really nice that the angle average popped out. That's what's going on. There's forces on this body, and the ones that don't average out give it a self-force. OK, so here's my summary and conclusions. Easy to remember answers. Self-force in any allowed gauge is just the angle average of the bare self-force in that gauge. Here's what gauges, technically, you're allowed to use. And that is a larger class of gauges than people have previously talked about. And I'm very happy, I guess, for selfish reasons, that John Friedman and his group appear to be using such a gauge. And then just to mention, it's nice to do all this for aesthetic reasons at first order, but the real payoff would be if this derivation generalized to second order. Because I don't know how to do second order by a brute force attack, but if this worked, it'd give a nice little regularization formula that someone like Lior or whoever would compute the second order metric perturbations and regularize them using that formula. So that would be great, but I don't have it for you. And I'm not going to promise it by next year either. and then finally, an easier thing, which I'll decide if it's interesting or not, is I suspect all of this generalizes past GR into just an arbitrary diffeomorphism covariant theory. You could add matter fields. You could add electromagnetism or some modified gravity theory. And if it's not much additional computation, that might be nice to see. You might You might be able to get the electromagnetic self-force out of Einstein-Maxwell theory. You might be able to treat matter fields like, I don't know, maybe you can find some expression that accounts for dynamical friction or some other interesting effect in the presence of matter, local matter. I don't know, but that's just some possible generalizations that maybe by next year. Okay, thank you very much.
Where you first
introduced Sam Burke. I think this is it. Probably here if you want the next slide. This is sort of where it comes from.
Oh, I see. Okay. So it's part of some definition you're using in that definition.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, when you do a center of mass in freshman physics, it is it's a weighted angle average.
Yeah. Okay. That's
where it comes from.
From the next slide, I couldn't see how it's getting it, but this is cool. Thank you.
Okay.
John? So a technical question on the your page computation. You were identifying these terms, grad zero, grad I, well, grad I xi zero with delta gi zero and so on.
Yeah.
Question is just what happened to the symmetrization.
Oh well, there's two.
So
there's
first,
two, first and third is symmetrized. Oh, this is zero zero.
Yeah, zero, zero.
Yeah, it does work.
I didn't see the group. Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Sure.
I must just miss something, but how is the average of the Bell force finite?
One
of R squared.
The average of one over
R squared. It's a force. It's one of our
average.
So in my living reviews, I construct a lot of averages like that. And if your word line doesn't have any acceleration, the averages works up to zero.
One of our squared. The average of that is one of our squared.
But if you have acceleration, then you get a contribution, which is the usual Matsui normalization that you would need to think about.
The other question is, surely the Algagian's well, at least that is not defined.
Yes.
You mentioned that yourself. And
well,
next, the question is that I would expect that it's not defined in the radiation gates.
In the which? In the radiation? Well, so John has.
Well, including the article 0 and 1. I mean, if you strictly speaking, the radiation gauge.
Oh, if you were going to use straight radiation gauge relative to 0 and 1, right.
But you don't have to.
You're still like
good
argument for not doing that.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Speaker also from Chicago.